community to come and save us. That's what people have been telling from the ground. You know, day by day, that toll is increasing and continuously.
We're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us, President of the Burmese Rohingya Association in London. And thank you so much to Richard Weir. That does it for our show. Tonight in New York, Juan Gonzalez will be unveiling his book at the New School. We hope everyone will come at 7 o'clock. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts beginning Friday, September 15th at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church in Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts will be featuring live folk music every third Friday of the month, beginning September 15th through May. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts every third Friday of the month, beginning Friday, September 15th at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, KBOO members. Join us at the KBOO annual meeting on Saturday, September 9th from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. The annual meeting is an opportunity for our members to come together, hear a report about the state of the station, and celebrate our community. This year, the meeting is dedicated to Michael Wells, who tragically passed on earlier this summer. As we celebrate the legacy of Michael, we will listen to some of the youth who contribute to our community and to what it means to follow their leadership. We hope to see you on Saturday, September 9th, from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. That's 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, as of this broadcast, the Eagle Creek Fire in the Columbia River Gorge is 5% contained, up from 0% yesterday.
A counter-protest is planned for Sunday's right-wing Patriot Prayer Rally in Portland, and we'll speak with some of the organizers.
Hurricane Irma has wrecked almost total devastation on some Caribbean islands, killing 10 people at last count.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 7th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Hurricane Irma blasted across the Caribbean on Thursday, killing at least 10 people and wreaking near total devastation on the islands. Barbudans tell their story of their night of misery that they say exceeded their worst fears. Miss Ned, a chairwoman of the Barbuda Council, said, quote, "We had cars flying over our heads. We had 40-foot containers flying left and right. People were literally tying themselves to roofs with ropes to hold them down," end quote. The damage left behind by Irma is a grim warning for people further west as they brace for the arrival of the hurricane days later. Of the worst hit were a few small islands where Irma hit first land, which including Franco-Dutch Island, St. Martin, and nearby Barbuda. Barely any building in Barbuda was left untouched, nearly a quarter of the properties completely obliterated. Half its people were left homeless because of the big storm. Ned continues to say that the experience was like something you see in a horror movie, not something you actually expect to see happen in reality. Gaston Brown, Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, told ABS-TV, saying, quote, "I'm of the view that it stands now, Barbuda is barely habitable. The island is literally underwater, and that in itself is a serious threat. We never anticipated this level of damage," end quote.
Irma has brought down telecom towers and destroyed backup radios throughout Barbuda, so now islanders are having a hard time reporting about the extent of the damage. Rescue efforts are also hampered by the damage to airports, since planes can't land safely very easily. The winds from Irma were so strong that it left some of the island's storm shelters overwhelmed, according to Barbudan Fire Station Chief Sergeant George. George said, quote, "The community center, which was one of the designated shelters, and the churches we used, did not stand up to the task. So we had to use St. Thomas Hospital, but that stood up well," end quote. On Irma's current course, it's predicted to pass by the northern shores of Haiti and the Dominican Republic on Thursday, according to The Guardian. It could also be directly over or quite close to the British territories of the Turk and Caicos Islands on the same night, followed by a grazing of the southern islands of the Cuba's northern coast and the Bahamas. On Friday night, The Guardian says that Irma is expected to land at or pass near the archipelago of the Florida Keys, where Governor Rick Scott has ordered an evacuation. It's unclear as of now where the storm will strike along the coast.
USA Today has recently released an article explaining many of the different records Irma has already broken in the recent days. Here are some of them. Irma has recently had 37 hours of sustained winds at 185 miles per hour, the longest any sort of tropical cyclone in the world has maintained yet that intensity. Super Typhoon Haiyan was the previous record holder in 2013 with 24 hours. At 185 miles per hour, Irma is the strongest storm on record to have hit the Leeward Islands, while the Okeechobee and David hurricanes were the previous strongest at 160 miles per hour. Extremely low pressures mean stronger hurricanes, and Irma is no exception. At 915 millibars, Irma has the lowest pressure of a hurricane in the Atlantic outside of the Gulf of Mexico and the Western Caribbean. That pressure has been the 10th lowest on record since 1966 and the lowest since Hurricane Dean in 2007. Irma has also generated nearly 44.2 units of accumulated cyclone energy, which is the most energy from a tropical cyclone on the record in the Atlantic. This kind of energy is added up wind energy units that have come from tropical system over its life. This record is also the most in a 24-hour time frame, breaking the record set by Allen in 1980.
An analysis from the Oregonian using federal fire data shows that as of Tuesday at 8 p.m., the Eagle Creek fire had only burned about 100 acres inside a protected buffer along the Bull Run drainage. However, the fire may be headed deeper. A NASA infrared satellite image shows one hotspot appearing on Tuesday at around 3:50 a.m. inside the drainage area. The Portland Water Bureau remains concerned about the threat, but has not had any problems providing water from Bull Run. Jamie Cudel, a spokeswoman from the Bureau, says that the city's water continues to be safe to drink. Even if the Bull Run water supply were to be threatened and evacuated, the city can switch to a backup supply. Fire is not unprecedented in Bull Run, but the area hasn't seen a big burn in more than a century. One of the more recent large ones burned 1,100 acres in the 20th century. 42 fires were found to be human-caused during said century, one of which was mentioned just before. All but two of those fires were from slash burning, and the others were from logging and a campfire.
According to local immigration activists, people are affected by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, are facing an uncertain future now that President Trump has rescinded the program. The action affects about 12,000 people in Oregon who were brought into the U.S. as children by undocumented parents. Here I am in conjunction with the Oregon News Service. As expected, the Trump administration announced Tuesday it would end a program protecting young immigrants brought to the United States as children. Put in place by Barack Obama in 2012, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program has protected about 12,000 people in Oregon and 800,000 people across the country as they go to school and work. Andrea Williams, head of the immigrants' rights group CAUSA, says the decision is causing anxiety among Oregon's DACA participants.
It's unfathomable to think that people who grew up their entire lives here, who literally do not know the country they came from when they were little, would be forced to leave their home. And that is a truly heartbreaking situation.
The program allows deferrals that protect the young people known as Dreamers from deportation as they go to college and apply for work permits. Federal officials say Dreamers whose DACA eligibility expires between now and March 5th can apply for permits, adding they won't target them for deportation after their deferrals expire. 10 states threatened legal action if DACA was not phased out by September 5th. President Donald Trump issued a statement Tuesday saying he does not favor punishing children for the actions of their parents, and says he wrestled with the decision, but Williams says that's little consolation for those who face an uncertain future.
The president and his administration have been nothing but cruel and heartless in this entire immigration situation. They did not need to do this. It was within the president's own power to continue the program, at least until Congress could show that they could pass a bill.
Williams says DACA recipients could be saved by the DREAM Act currently in Congress, which would provide a path to citizenship.
Passing the DREAM Act is solely in the hands right now of Republican leadership in Congress. And so we will continue to advocate and ask our only Republican Congressman, Greg Walden, who is in Republican leadership, to work with us.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
The Oregon Department of Transportation has proposed a $450 million expansion of Interstate 5 through the heart of Portland. Adding lanes and shoulders, the agency says, would reduce congestion and crashes. But a few hundred people and several groups have asked the city to drop its support, saying that the project would only be a temporary solution to congestion because it would prompt Portlanders to drive more often. A spokesman for the coalition said, quote, "We know climate change is real and happening right now, and 40% of our city's carbon emissions come from auto emissions." This expansion, according to the State Transportation Department, would save 6.5 minutes during the morning commute and 8 minutes in the evening. Opponents think that this is too optimistic and say the state should first add tolling along the corridor, which would then push drivers to reduce their trips. Joe Courtwright, a Portland economist, said, quote, "If you really want to eliminate congestion, the only way to do it is by pricing the use of roads," end quote. Aides for Commissioner Dan Saltzman said he'll seek a possible resolution asking the state to add tolls before beginning the new expansion project.
And now we go to our friends at Public News Service for a daily roundup of stories from around the country. For more public interest reporting from all 50 states, visit publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, September the 7th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. Featured on today's nationwide rundown, the EPA review of fuel standards called a waste of time and money, a First Amendment win for a West Virginia journalist, and just in time for back to school, a kindness curriculum for teachers. Now, our top story, a president who prides himself on being unpredictable confounded members of his own party Wednesday by cutting a deal with congressional Democrats to raise a debt ceiling. According to the Washington Post, Trump's move upended sensitive negotiations over the debt ceiling and other crucial policy areas this fall. The EPA has proposed reopening its review of fuel efficiency requirements, a move critics say could only benefit automakers at taxpayers' expense.
When the requirements were first set, major car manufacturers publicly agreed to achieving an average of 54.5 miles to the gallon for cars and light trucks by 2025. That goal was an important part of national efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. According to Carol Lee Ron, director of the transportation program at CERIS, that goal was reaffirmed by an EPA midterm review less than a year ago, and nothing has changed since.
EPA has conducted exhaustive analyses showing that costs have actually come down since the standards were initially conceived in 2012 and that they are indeed feasible.
Car makers argue that low gas prices and high demand for sport utility vehicles now make those goals difficult to achieve. The EPA is accepting public comments through October 5th. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
In Pennsylvania, areas such as Lancaster and Allegheny counties and the city of Philadelphia have chronic problems meeting federal clean air standards. Hurricane Irma tore a treacherous path through the Lesser Antilles Wednesday. Reuters reports the Category 5 hurricane is now one of the most powerful Atlantic hurricanes in the century, claiming lives on four islands, including St. Martin and St. Barts. Current projections have Irma reaching Florida sometime this weekend. A group of attorneys general from 15 states and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit Wednesday to stop the administration from rescinding DACA. But Veronica Carter tells us immigrants or the so-called dreamers who live in the state of Illinois aren't going to see their state protect them when it comes to immigration reform.
Governor Bruce Rauner says he's not getting involved with President Trump's plan to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA program, despite a request by Chicago's mayor to establish an Illinois Bill of Rights for undocumented immigrants. Also at odds with the governor on the issue is Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan, who joined a multi-state lawsuit on Wednesday designed to keep DACA going. The governor, speaking at a health center in Lawndale on Wednesday, said he doesn't think the issue should be handled individually by states.
I do not believe this challenge for these children can be addressed on a state-by-state basis. I think that would not be correct. We need a comprehensive immigration reform. It should be done at the federal level for the entire nation and should be done by Congress.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said Trump's decision to end legal protection for 800,000 immigrant children contradicts the assurances he gave before he was elected and says that will come back to haunt him.
Now to a First Amendment win. A West Virginia journalist from our newsroom, whose arrest drew national attention, is now officially off the hook. Mary Sherman has more.
Prosecutors dismissed charges on Wednesday against Dan Hyman, a reporter for Public News Service, who faced 6 months of jail time for an incident in May at the state capitol. The official complaint alleged Hyman caused a disturbance by yelling questions at U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. Hyman did not know at the time that Price was walking in a group that included White House advisor Kellyanne Conway. Hyman's attorney, Tim DePiro, explains video evidence shows Hyman did not violate the law.
Dan was told to stay away from her, meaning Kellyanne Conway, and from the video you can see he precisely does that. He stays away from her and runs ahead to catch up with Tom Price, and then within seconds, he's arrested with no other admonition.
DePiro adds that while freedom of the press is important, it isn't always respected. Not long after Hyman's arrest, a reporter for The Guardian was body slammed by a Montana congressman, and a journalist was pinned against a wall by security guards at an FCC news conference.
Public News Service founder Lark Corbet says she's appreciative of the help from the legal team and journalism groups who continually fight for First Amendment rights. And finally, as kids begin the school year, Tim Morrissey reports teachers may wonder how to integrate social and emotional learning in the classroom along with reading, writing, and math.
That's one of the concepts behind the new kindness curriculum developed for teachers by the UW-Madison Center for Healthy Minds. The curriculum helps preschool teachers encourage children to learn to deal with their emotions and learn concepts like kindness and forgiveness. Marianne Spoon of the center says that preschool years are an important time for brain development.
We were curious how this might work and whether it would be an effective approach for teachers and for students. But we're also really looking at it from a prevention-oriented perspective. So how can we start out kids early in life to set them on a positive developmental trajectory?
Spoon says it's more effective to address these issues at the preschool level than to wait for emotional problems to develop later.
Early findings show that children who participated in the curriculum improved on social and emotional measures and also performed better on traditional academic measures. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth live interview with the group Portland Stands United Against Hate, which is planning a counter-protest during a right-wing rally in Portland on Sunday. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be likely overcast with a high around 73 and a low of 57. Today in history, in 1940, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, began bombing London and other British cities. The Blitz, as the campaign came to be called, lasted for 50 consecutive days and killed over 40,000 civilians. Also on this day in 2008, the U.S. government took over the two largest mortgage financing companies in the country, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, during the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. The quote of the day is from British economist Joan Armstrong, who said, "The purpose of studying economics is not to acquire a set of ready-made answers to economic questions, but to learn how to avoid being deceived by economists.
It's 5:19, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One of the lucky things about being rich is that you automatically become handsome. Your jokes are hilarious, and politicians treat you with fawning deference. On the other hand, the unlucky thing about being poor is that, well, you're poor, and society generally treats you poorly. Indeed, morally corrupt right-wing officials in Washington and across the country are pushing the idea that poor people must be punished, as if debilitating poverty is not punishment enough. One especially ugly example of this is spreading through hundreds of school districts, an abhorrent practice called lunch shaming. From first grade through senior class, most schools make families pay for their kids' cafeteria lunch, and a computer program alerts cashiers when a student's lunch account is unpaid, a shortfall that nearly always involves poverty-level kids. Rather than dealing with this discreetly, school systems have taken to publicly humiliating children whom the computer tags as having a meal debt. Some schools literally take an indebted student's tray of food away, making a show of dumping the lunch in the trash in front of everyone. Some remove the hot food from the child's tray, replacing it with a cold sandwich of white bread and a slice of cheese, claiming that this so-called sandwich meets federal nutrition standards. Others actually brand the offenders, using markers to write, "I need lunch money," on the poor kid's arms. Nearly half of America's school districts use some form of shaming and stigmatizing, embarrassing children to tears. This is Jim Hightower saying, what educational lesson is this teaching? And what's the matter with school boards and lawmakers who are either allowing or directly causing this abuse, using lunch to punish the poor? Being poor means you lack money. Being mean to the poor means you lack a soul.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we go to our friends at Native Voice One with their daily segment, National Native News. You can find more stories and podcasts every day at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A group of First Nations in Manitoba have declared a state of emergency. They say it's over a drug crisis on their reserves, and it's sparking an increase in crime. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The drug crisis in many major North American cities is also affecting First Nations. The chiefs who declared the emergency are from the Dakota Ojibwe Tribal Council, made up of seven First Nations. They say in addition to the higher crime rates, there are health issues and more suicides. Suicides have already resulted in individual First Nations communities in Manitoba and Ontario declaring their own states of emergency. Drugs have plagued First Nations for years, and the Dakota Ojibwe Council says it's now even worse. Ken Chalmers speaks for the council. He says now the drug crisis is affecting children and even babies.
In the last year in my community, 60% of our children born were put on morphine after birth because of the addictions of the mothers.
The chiefs agreed to work on a strategy to tackle the crisis. They say they will focus on education, prevention, and enforcement. But they also say they can't do it alone and need help from the federal and provincial governments to build an addiction treatment facility. The chiefs say they will also cooperate with local law enforcement agencies to prevent drugs from entering their reserves. Any band members who are caught selling drugs will be expelled from the community. Members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police attended the chief's meeting and assured them there would be protection for people who come forward with information about illegal drugs. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Fry bread will no longer play a part in the annual Miss Navajo Nation pageant. The change marks a shift toward traditional foods and away from the staple that was born out of government rations during the Navajo people's forced relocation in the 1860s. In the past, contestants have been judged for the texture and taste of fry bread, as well as their fire building and cooking techniques. The largest donation in the history of a Minnesota medical school will be used to establish a Native American Center of Excellence. The University of Minnesota at Duluth received a $10 million gift from an anonymous donor who recently learned about his own Native American roots. Melissa Walls is an associate professor who studies mental and behavioral health at the Duluth campus. She is Boys Fort and Kuchiching First Nation Ojibwe, and she hopes the money will bolster the program's longstanding emphasis on recruiting Native students and fellows.
If we could figure out a way to at least partially or fully fund some of those positions for Native people, I think that would be awesome.
As a researcher, Walls says she's dreaming up projects about diabetes prevention and the healing effects of sweat lodges. But more than any specific project, she'd like to see the $10 million help build the medical school's capacity to do collaborative research with tribal communities.
Maybe this is an opportunity for us to pinpoint some of the needs of our local tribes and then use some of the awesome resources within our building to build partnerships to address issues that matter.
The dean of the Duluth campus, Dr. Paula Termulin, told the St. Paul Pioneer Press that just 1% of the nation's doctors are Native American. Two tribes recently got the go-ahead to bypass the Bureau of Indian Affairs' approval of land lease deals for businesses. Law360.com reports the BIA this summer approved both the Osage Nation and the Stillaguamish tribes to enter into leases without the Bureau's approval, as provided by a 2012 statute. Known as the Hearth Act, the statute allows tribes to avoid the sometimes burdensome process of getting BIA approval for land lease deals that involve tribal property. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Yate, support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Everybody knows that college students are responsible, sober managers of their assets and finances. But for those few outliers, KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, has some advice to offer. It's an exciting time of year for students heading off to college for the first time, but with that independence comes new responsibilities. One of the most important is financial responsibilities. Every student, whether they are living off student loans, a part-time job, or checks from their parents, has to budget their resources wisely and should track their spending. Lynn Hyder with the Northwest Credit Union Association says credit cards can be a tempting way to stretch the budget.
You, as a college student, are going to go to the mailbox in your dorm every week, and there will be a new credit card offer there. Be careful about how much credit and debt you take on. Beware of those offers.
Hyder says because credit unions are not-for-profit cooperatives, they offer lower interest rates on credit cards than other financial institutions. Hyder also notes it's best to establish good habits and pay off the card each month. Mobile apps can make this easier and can also help people detect fraudulent activity in their accounts more quickly. Students also should keep their eyes open for discounts. Computer manufacturers often offer student deals. College campuses usually have discounts for their restaurants and markets. Then there is time spent off campus. Hyder says everybody needs to get away from their studies and enjoy themselves, but that doesn't have to mean footing friends' bills.
Don't get stuck picking up the tab for everybody else's pizza and beers. Pay only your share. And the best way to do this is to take cash and have in mind an amount that you're going to spend for the evening of entertainment, and then stick to that.
Finally, and most importantly, Hyder says students should enjoy college life. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
Betsy DeVos is seeking to roll back portions of Title IX. The title is part of the Education Act Amendment of 1972 that states that no persons participating in federally funded programs will be discriminated against for their gender. If an institution displays a gender bias, such as failing to provide a safe environment for its students, it can possibly have funds withheld. DeVos has announced plans to review and restructure the sections that deal with sexual assault on campuses because she believes that it overly favors the victims of sexual assault and overly punishes the accused. In the wake of the many high-profile sexual assault cases on campuses, the Obama administration tried to take colleges to task by issuing the Dear Colleague letter. DeVos stated that, quote, "The truth is that the system established by the prior administration has failed too many students. Survivors, victims of a lack of due process, and campus administrators have all told me that the current approach does a disservice to everyone involved," end quote. Title IX also offered protections for transgendered students, although many of the transgender protections have recently been rescinded. Former Vice President Joe Biden stated via Facebook that, quote, "The truth is, although people don't want to talk about the brutal reality of sexual assault, especially when it occurs in our most cherished institutions, it is our reality, and it must be faced head on, and any change that weakens Title IX protections will be devastating."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says despite not supporting Trump, the Labor Federation has met with Trump's administration laying out things that would help workers. The AFL-CIO also has made it clear that if Trump embraces policies that really help workers, the AFL-CIO will support those policies. But Trumka says instead of helping workers, Trump has been hurting us, and the AFL-CIO's advice on how to really help workers for the most part has been ignored.
When he started attacking things like health and safety standards, coal mine standards, and those regulations, I had several meetings with the administration, told them the adverse and bad effect that that had on workers, showed them a position that would reverse that and actually help workers, make places more safe or increase wages, and gave that to the administration. Unfortunately, in most cases, that wasn't taken.
Organized labor is part of the Hurricane Harvey relief effort. The Texas Workers Relief Fund was set up by the Texas AFL-CIO. The national AFL-CIO is donating $100,000 to that fund and is raising $5 million more dollars. The AFL-CIO Housing Investment Trust is also investing $500 million over 5 years into affordable housing in areas affected by Harvey. National Nurses United is deploying over 1,000 volunteer nurses to hurricane-hit areas, from first responders to IBEW electrical workers working overtime to restore and repair damage to the electric power grid. Labor is pitching in to help. The AFL-CIO also says the Building Investment Trust, a bank collective trust that provides risk-adjusted returns for union pension plans, and Ulico, a labor movement-affiliated financial service company, are working with the AFL-CIO on job-creating commercial real estate and infrastructure investment. The AFL-CIO's Liz Schuler says working people and our unions all across America are giving our cash donations, our investment capital, and our solidarity. Gallup says 61% of Americans approve of labor unions. It's the annual poll Gallup has been doing on unions since 1936, always showing strong support for labor unions. Gallup says that number is the highest percentage since the 65% approval recorded in 2003. According to decades of annual Gallup polling results, historically unions have enjoyed strong support from the American public. In 1936, 72% of Americans approved of labor unions. Union approval peaked in the 1950s when it reached 75% in 1953 and 1957.
Let's get America working. We must build, maintain, and repair our nation's crumbling infrastructure. Teamsters support a bipartisan approach to creating good jobs for American workers. Learn more at letsgetamericaworking.com. Teamsters strong, America stronger.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now we have Labor History in Two, a project of the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, And this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day hundreds of ILWU strikers blocked railroad tracks near Longview, Washington. They hoped to stop grain shipments from moving in and out of the EGT grain terminal. Longshoremen had been sitting down on the tracks throughout the summer, resulting in over 100 arrests. No trains had moved in or out of the terminal since July. But then a federal judge issued an injunction against ILWU pickets. The BNSF Railroad tried to move grain once again. ILWU picketers in Vancouver were able to hold off the train until police forcibly dispersed the crowd. Then, hundreds gathered at Longview to block the train from coming in. That's when police went on the offensive. They used clubs and pepper spray against the longshoremen, arresting 19. They threw ILWU President Bob McElrath to the ground. Rumors spread that police had broken his arm. Hundreds of regional longshoremen rushed to Longview. The Seattle and Tacoma ports shut down in protest. The next morning, 10,000 tons of grain were opened onto the railroad tracks. The grain export terminal was the first to be built in the Pacific Northwest in almost 30 years. EGT hoped to undercut the powerful ILWU, who controlled operations at the port since its founding in the 1930s. The union refused to agree to work 12-hour shifts at straight time. The EGT hoped to break the hiring hall by refusing to recognize maintenance and inside workers at the terminal. They then attempted to fill jobs with workers from the operating engineers. But the ILWU persevered. By the end of January, EGT had backed off many of its demands, negotiations resumed, and days later, the contract was signed.
As hundreds of thousands of Rohingya are fleeing persecution in Myanmar and seeking protection in Bangladesh, they have more than what lies behind them to fear, as rumors are spreading far and wide that Myanmar army is now mining the border between the two countries. The recent slate of violence in the northern province of Rakhine was caused when a group of Rohingya insurgents attacked an army base and, according to a local news outlet, killed 400 people. Around 250,000 people have already fled the country via land, and many more are beginning to take to the sea, a Mediterranean ship that has been used to rescue refugees fleeing Africa in the Mediterranean Sea, is leaving its port in Malta and is now headed to Southeast Asia in order to give the refugees a way out of what seems to be a hopeless situation.
As the global climate changes, water shortages in arid regions are only going to get worse. In a place like the occupied territories of Palestine, such shortages are already impacting politics and human rights. KBOOB reporter Sam Bowman has more.
A war of words and water is simmering in the Jordan River Valley, with some parts of the occupied Palestinian territories dangerously close to the boiling point. According to the International Middle East Media Center, based in Bethlehem, occupation authorities are reducing the water supply to Palestinian homes and farms. Mo'ataz Bisharat of the Palestinian Authority, or PA, claimed in an interview with Quds Press that the cutoffs were limited to Palestinian settlements. The Israeli water company Mekarot is still pumping water to Israeli settlements in the northern Jordan Valley, he says. Practically speaking, this means that many Palestinian settlements do get some water, but it does not make it to every neighborhood. The Jordan Valley has been enduring an historic drought this year. After 4 years of minimal rains, the storied Sea of Galilee in the northern part of the valley reached its lowest level for August in 100 years. According to the Israeli news service Haaretz, the Israeli Water Authority says that with one more year like this one, the lake could reach its lowest recorded depth. Soon, according to climate change news, droughts like the current one could recur almost every year. The situation looks drastic for the whole region, especially the Kingdom of Jordan across the river from the West Bank. The Middle East is one of the most water-poor and politically unstable regions in the world, adding up to a dire forecast for the area. In the occupied territories, the recent water shutoffs are only the latest development in the ongoing encroachment of Israeli settlements into Palestinian land, and many who live in or support those settlements don't think the shutoffs go far enough. The far-right, staunchly pro-settlement news service Aretz Sheva, for example, also known as Israel National News, has been reporting that Palestinians illegally siphoning water are largely responsible for the shortage. It is unclear if such accusations played into the government's decision-making. Water siphoning by Palestinians does occur, but the accusations of Aretz Sheva and others largely disregard the ongoing drought conditions and the fact that the majority of the international community views Israeli settlements as an encroachment on Palestinian land. Moataz Bisharat with the PA again also points out that the Israeli government prevents Palestinian companies from tapping groundwater in the West Bank. He says that while the water supply is controlled by Israel, it is, quote, impossible to radically solve the problem of water shortage. There are some ongoing attempts, however. Earlier this summer, U.S. envoy to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process Jason Greenblatt helped broker an agreement between Israel and the PA that would have Israel selling more water annually to Palestinians. It's part of a larger trilateral deal that would establish a water desalinization plant on the Red Sea in Aqaba, Jordan, connected to a pipeline running 200 kilometers to the Dead Sea.
I'm just a volunteer.
For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Isabel Cochran and Grace Ann Smith. Their producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Ben Shiregi. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Celos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, it's Beloved Community, Philosophical and Spiritual Foundations for Nonviolence, Activism, and Peace Building. At 10, it's Threshold Shift, a Resident Sound Artist series. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide looks at how to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep them from harming us. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment, and we want you to become a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This Sunday, September 10th, there will be a rally and march against white nationalism at Terry Schrunk Plaza in downtown Portland. It is in response to a rally planned by the group Patriot Prayer, led by Joey Gibson of Vancouver, Washington. Gibson's group professes that it is not racist or violent, but its several rallies in Portland and up and down the Western Seaboard since January have served as a Trojan horse for open white supremacist and nationalist groups. They have armed security and members of the Oregon Three Percenters and Oath Keepers, anti-government militia groups that were born in opposition to the Obama administration and have flourished under the current president.
Neo-Nazis, white supremacist groups like Identity Europa, and so-called Western chauvinist brawlers like the Proud Boys have had a prominent presence at all Patriot Prayer rallies. Many groups and individuals in Portland have showed up to counter these rallies this year. One prominent coalition of groups hoping to drown out the hate coming from Patriot Prayer's rally is Portland Stands United Against Hate. Today we have in the studio Damon Matsuri, who is with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Damon, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you here. Tell us about the Physicians for Social United Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Yeah, there's a lot of names there.
There's a lot of words there. Tell us about it.
Sure. So Physicians for Social Responsibility is the U.S. chapter of an international organization committed to going against nuclear war and militarism more broadly. So Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility was founded in 1981 by a group of doctors and other health professionals that were concerned about the Hanford site in Washington, as well as nuclear weapons proliferation. Since then, we've expanded to look at a wide range of other social issues, particularly how they affect public health and safety. So we work on things like militarism, gun safety, climate change, and environmental justice.
How many members do you have? Do you know, Damon?
We represent approximately 2,000 health professionals from across the state of Oregon.
Awesome. I want to clarify something. We have a group here in Portland called Portland United Against Hate, which is a coalition. And we have your group, Portland Stands United Against Hate. Do you know the difference between the two? Are you familiar with the other one? Can you help us here?
I don't know very much about the first group that you mentioned, but Portland Stands United Against Hate was formed in direct response to the stabbings of the MAX train and various white nationalist movements assembling in Portland. In particular, their first big event was on June 4th in response to one of Patriot Prayer's events.
And can you tell us about the protest you're helping plan for this Sunday?
I can. So approximately 80 organizations and community leaders, including the grandmother of Quanis Hayes, who was killed by the Portland police, will be co-sponsoring this event. And so it's a wide, wide coalition of groups, and we are assembling in direct response to the hate speech and very violent rhetoric of alt-right groups and the white nationalist assembly.
Damon, we're concerned about violence. Our listeners are concerned about that. Do you think that there will be violence? How are you expecting to deal with that in the context of this rally?
Groups within Portland Stands United Against Hate are committed to nonviolence and are not planning on escalating any situations. So our main concern is about the white nationalist group itself. They tend to bring a lot of sort of threatening equipment and things when they gather together. So we're mostly concerned about that. But we are acknowledging that it is not necessary. Safety is not guaranteed. I think we've seen in Charlottesville that you can do everything right and still have some scary stuff happen. And so we're acknowledging that, and we're encouraging people to come out anyway because it's so important to stand up to this as an issue within our city.
Do you have any advice for attendees as far as protecting themselves from pepper spray or just? Not little, but things like that.
Yeah, it's good to not wear contact lenses. If you do wear lenses, wear glasses instead. Bring a dry bandana. Those are good precautions to have just in case something like what happened on May Day happens again, where the police rescinded the permit based on a few individual actions and didn't communicate well to the group. So just in case something like that happens again, dry bandana, no contact lenses, something to flush your eyes out with. And so those are all worst case scenario issues, but those are some recommendations. There will also be security marshals on the perimeter, volunteers within Portland Stands United Against Hate, who are going to be wearing orange vests on the perimeter, who are going to be keeping an eye on things.
Have you had contact with the police bureau about the rally? Do you expect a major police presence? What's your coordination and interaction?
The rally is permitted. We've had open lines of communication with the Portland Police Bureau, and they're aware of our rally and march. And so that it's all being worked out with open lines of communication.
Do you expect a major presence of the police and a lot of direction from them about this?
I know that the police will definitely be at the Salmon Street Fountain, where the white nationalists are planning to assemble. They have said that they're not going to patrol as much our rally because it's we've been working with them. So.
And Joey Gibson, the founder and face of Patriot Prayer, has claimed that his rallies are about peace and love, and all violence is the fault of counter-protesters. What is your response to that claim?
So we've seen these messages as well, and what we've also seen is that the people who come out for Joey Gibson's events are not about that. And so regardless of the messaging, we've still seen things like Jeremy Christian turning out to Gibson's events, who, of course, threatened two women of color on the MAX train and ended up stabbing the two men who defended them. And so we see people like Jeremy Christian who use these rallies as a platform for spreading their message of hate. And it really is a direct public health and safety risk to have people like these assembling in our city, which is, you know, why Physicians for Social Responsibility sees this as such an important issue. On a personal note, I'm also openly identified as queer, and I see some of the rhetoric of groups that are marching in Charlottesville and other places, and it really profoundly affects me. And even if you're not a member of one of those marginalized groups, even if you're not a person of color, it perhaps especially if you're not a person of color, this is a really amazing opportunity to use your privilege to stand up for racial justice and all sorts of marginalized groups.
Damon, next week, starting on Monday, KABU is running in the evening news a special five-part series on the hate murders that occurred on the metro station. You just mentioned mm-hmm. Jeremy Christian. Mm-hmm. We'll be profiling what happened that day and talking with community leaders and others, Muslim, people of color, the mayor, Senator Wyden, and others. Each day we have about a 10-minute sequence on that. My experience with in discussing this matter is that there's a fundamental issue of mental health associated with hate crime. Do you agree with that? Is that a problem? And if so, how do we deal with it?
So, I mean, I'm not really qualified to talk about mental health. I myself am not a health professional. I represent health professionals for my work. So I'll preface it with that. I can't really speak too much to that. But I think what we're seeing is a rise in hate crimes and hate speech on all fronts in this current political climate. And we have to stand up and directly face that and confront that.
Right. I understand that your area is not mental health, so I'm asking you something from outside your circle of knowledge there. But I do feel the more I talk with people about these issues that there are fundamental matters of public health and mental health that are involved. It's not just hate crime. It's how people are functioning. And Jeremy Christian is a good example of someone who was not functioning in a healthy mental way. It wasn't just hate crime. That's simply the visible issue that comes to our attention. What else should we expect on Sunday if we are able to turn out?
So there will be a van that follows up the rear of the march, just to provide a little bit of extra cover at the back. We saw that car in Charlottesville that was a really scary sort of a sudden act of violence on peaceful protesters. So we're doing everything that we can to provide safe exit routes for people who need to leave the scene if they feel like they need to at any point. There's going to be a lot of people who are experts on the scene being able to communicate to people if anything changes all of a sudden.
I take it you're expecting a big crowd. Is that right?
That's what we're hoping for.
Roughly how big a crowd do you think will be there?
It's really hard to say. Individual churches have said they're turning out 100 people or more each. So it's hard to know, especially because some of those people aren't on Facebook and aren't RSVPing. We're expecting to at least double the number of people who've RSVP'd to the Patriot Prayer event. So we're going to be outnumbering them by a lot.
Is the event in here in Portland in any way paralleling other national events on this same day for the same kind of rationale?
I don't know too much about what's planned in the rest of the country for September 10th, but I do know that this is something that I'm trying to get as many people to show up for, because we saw Boston and Berkeley really successful turnouts for white nationalist rallies that were planned in their cities, and that was proved to be a really effective way to counter that message in those two cities. So if we can turn out as many people as possible here in Portland, it'll be a really effective way to shut down that violent rhetoric.
And I'm curious, you said you expect at least two times where people that RSVP to the nationalist rally. How many people did?
I don't know the exact number. I know that I think it's somewhere around 200. I'm not sure mm-hmm. exactly.
Well, Damon, it's been a pleasure. Is there anything we should have asked you which we might have overlooked, or anything you'd like to bring up? And here's a question that I just realized is on our list here, right? There are people who may want to show their opposition but can't come on Sunday or feel unsafe for some reason. What are other ways they can show support for your message?
So there are a number of sort of sibling rallies and demonstrations happening at the same time in other parts of downtown that are not going to be running right up against the white nationalist group. So I encourage you to take a look at the Portland Stands United Against Hate Facebook event for September 10th. You can find that by going to OregonPSR.org, and there will be a nice big banner that redirects you to that information. And so there's a number of different sort of, like I said, sibling campaigns that are linked to from that Facebook event. So,
well, that's a new term for me, sibling campaign. But I understand the idea. And so those who do not want to go directly into the heart of the matter, but still want to be seen as opposed, can go to a sibling event.
That's right. You can also just come at 12:30 at Terry Shrunk Plaza and just rally there and don't join the march. You can also do that, and then that will you'll still be away from the Salmon Street fountain with the white nationalist rally.
So what have we failed to ask you that you'd like to mention, if anything?
I'd just like to reiterate that this is an opportunity for progressive Portlanders to really show up in defense of marginalized communities. So this is an opportunity for you to really turn out and live up to the Portland reputation of being a progressive city committed to fighting racism, fighting transphobia, homophobia and Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, all of these things and more. This is an opportunity where we can show up and protect what matters in our community.
Damon Matsutori, from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Damon, thanks for coming to KBOO this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
We wish you well with this effort and hope you get a lot of support for it.
Likewise, hope to see many people there.
And do you mind just giving us a quick rundown of the event and when it's going to happen so that our listeners have a chance to kind of get it in their brains?
This Sunday, September 10th at 12:30 p.m., Terry Shrunk Plaza, corner of Southwest Madison and 4th Avenue. And that's the Portland Stands United Against Hate Coalition Rally and March Against White Nationalism.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Damon, thank you.
Unknown. My heart has an ache, it's as heavy as stone. Will the dawn coming on make it light? I cover the waterfront, I'm watching the sea. Will the one I love be coming back to me? I cover the waterfront in search of my love, and I'm covered by a starless sky above. Here am I, patiently waiting, hoping and longing. Oh, how I yearn. Where are you? Are you forgetting? The waterfront, must soon come back to me. For the one I love must soon come back to me.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. The Ingenio Milagro Playfest will feature four plays by Latinx playwrights and a concert readings over 3 days after a short rehearsal period. The playwrights will also get to work with the guest artist Daniel Jacquez. Again, that's Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.